WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America is divided over whether gay and lesbian couples should have the right to marry. In the past few months, the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled in favor of gay marriage, and gay couples were married in the city halls of San Francisco, New Paltz, New York, and Portland, Oregon, until gay marriages were halted. Opponents of gay marriage are advocating a constitutional amendment, which President Bush supports, that would define marriage as an institution for heterosexual couples only. Today we're going to look at the history of marriage in America and see what clues it might offer about gay marriage and how gay marriage would affect the future of the institution. My first guest is Nancy Cott, author of Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. She's a professor of history at Harvard University. As a legal historian who has written about the history of marriage, do you support the legalization of gay marriage?
I think that it is the next phase of evolution of marriage in our society. Yes, I think that marriage has been developing toward an institution that is a union of two people to establish a secure household. And the parity between those two individuals has become more of a feature of the institution itself. The gender roles of the two members have become less distinguishable, the one from the other, in the past, say, 50 years. And I think equality and privacy between the partners have become the leading features of the institution, as well as the security of their commitment to each other. So that, in that sense, I think marriage between same-sex couples is following right along that line and is undoubtedly to come.
People who oppose gay marriage say it's always been about one man and one woman, and that should be unchangeable.
Within religiously understood Christian marriage, that is certainly the case. But more importantly, marriage in the United States has been authorized civilly. That is, it is a civil, secular institution in terms of its force, its authority, its legality. That is civil, not religious. The religious attributes of marriage are voluntary on the part of the couple. And the people who are most committed to the impossibility of same-sex marriage are committed in that way from a religious point of view. But their attitude, their sense of the institution is really an optional one. It's not one that's built into the law of marriage or the authority of the institution, why it has force legally. That rests with the state and has always in the United States. That is, since the colonies, in fact, but if we start with the United States itself, with the post-1776 nation, it's unquestionably true.
Let's look at some of the ways the marriage laws have changed over the years. Let's start with the early marriage laws in the United States. What did those early marriage laws say about what marriage was and what the role of the husband and the wife within marriage would be?
Looking at early marriage laws in the American colonies and then in the early states, perhaps the most important thing that need be said is much of the law of marriage was an unwritten law. It was part of the so-called common law of England, which had never been written down, so that the husband's obligation to support his wife, for instance, or the wife's obligation to obey her husband, to turn her property over to him, to work for him, in other words, her labor belonged to him, it was not hers to contract independently. Those things were not necessarily written down in a given state's laws. They needn't be to be enforced in the early United States because those understandings of marriage were part of common law. And if any case came to court, any objection were raised, it would be common law that was cited.
And when did that start to change?
It started to change in the middle of the 19th century, in part because of women's rights advocates arguing that this demise of the wife's legal individuality was unjust and unreal, didn't represent what women were really doing. And in part because of a slightly more complicated understanding by legislators of what families' interests were. The first way these laws changed was through what were called married women's property laws, which allowed a wife to keep possession of property she might have come into the marriage with, keep it in her own name, or perhaps gain property during the marriage and keep it in her own name. A major reason why such laws were passed were not what we might see today as feminist reasons, that is, to preserve the wife's individuality. It was really to preserve some portion of the family's sustenance and household goods against creditors who might be seeking to collect against the husband, so that there was a community of interest in preserving some property in the wife's name.
Why were marriage laws state laws? Why wasn't there just one federal set of marriage laws that all the states followed?
Marriage laws were seen as part of the state's police power, which is the power to protect and guard its population's health, safety, and welfare. The same reason that states have authority over local schools in the United States jurisprudence is the reason they have the authority over marriage. It's considered a domestic interest, an extension of the state's desire and obligation to protect its population in a very close sense. And the states early on were very jealous of those powers, did not want to cede those powers to the federal government. The domestic relations included not only husband and wife, they included master and servant and master and slave. And certainly in the early United States, where the slaveholding states had very different ideas about the household, who should be free in it, who should be enslaved, who should have the power over others, the states were not likely to want a uniform law when there were such diversities of opinion of how domestic relations writ large should be organized.
Gay and lesbian couples are not legally allowed to marry now, although that is certainly being challenged in several states. What are some of the other groups of people historically that were not allowed to marry during certain parts of American history?
Well, the most stunning things about marriage prohibition in American history have to do with race. And this both existed during the time of slavery in the United States and postdated it. Slaves were not able to marry legally. That was based on their condition as slaves, not literally on their race. As slaves, they did not have the power to consent. They had no civil rights because their masters had all rights over them. And the denial of legal marriage to them was one of those deprivations, one of those ways in which they had no civil rights. But quite apart from slavery, there were laws that go back as far as the 1660s and the 1680s in the Chesapeake colonies of Virginia and Maryland that made it illegal, impossible, null for a white person to marry a Negro or mulatto. Those were the terms used at the time and used all the way up through the early 20th century. These laws were designed by white legislators and upheld by white judges to preserve what they saw as racial purity. And there were laws that also prevented a white person from having a legal marriage to a Native American in a number of states, about 8 or 10 states. And then certain Western states, I think it was as many as 15 Western states at some time, had laws that made marriage between a white and a Chinese or a Japanese or another Asian of some description illegal or criminal.
Now, how long did it take until all of these laws banning interracial marriages were off the books?
It was in 1967 in a U.S. Supreme Court decision called Loving versus Virginia. Loving was, ironically, fittingly, the name of the couple who challenged the law in Virginia. In 1967, the Supreme Court, using an equal protection argument, said that these laws violated constitutional rights of Americans because marriage was a fundamental right. The right to choose one's partner was a fundamental right. And at that point, the Supreme Court said the argument from symmetry, a black cannot marry a white, true, but a white cannot marry a black. So no racial discrimination is implied here. That argument was specious because the purpose of the law clearly was to maintain white supremacy, that the law had a racially discriminatory purpose and therefore couldn't be regarded as operating symmetrically.
My guest is Nancy Kott. She's a professor of history at Harvard University and the author of Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nancy Kott. She's a professor of history at Harvard University and author of the book Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. And in the light of gay and lesbian couples asking for the legal right to marry, we're looking at some of the many ways that marriage laws have changed over the centuries in the United States. For people too young to remember this, can you talk a little bit about what it took to get a divorce before the no-fault divorce era?
I think many people are surprised to hear how long divorce has been possible in the United States, that this country was in the vanguard in granting divorce. Most states have had some form of divorce shortly after the American Revolution, but it was difficult to get a divorce until maybe the mid-19th century, when more grounds for divorce were mentioned. Initially, the only reason one could get a divorce was adultery or desertion if one partner simply left. But for a person to get a divorce traditionally, the innocent party had to prove that the guilty party had committed an infraction of or had just failed to fulfill an obligation of the marriage agreement. And in certain states, and New York was prime here, in certain states, marriage, the grounds for divorce were still very minimal. New York State was one of the most conservative. And in New York, up to the 1950s, the only ground for divorce was adultery. So that couples who wanted to divorce and really had come to the conclusion that their marriage had fallen apart, both of them wanted a divorce, they were setting up or colluding, as the verb was, colluding, framing a scene of adultery by one partner with a witness seeing it so that they could then get a lawyer, go to court, say the grounds have been met, one party was guilty, we want a divorce. And it was lawyers, really, and the American Bar Association who felt that this was a very bad scene, felt that collusion to fulfill the law, so really open flouting of the law, was what it was taking to cause divorce, and that, in fact, divorce for irretrievable breakdown of a marriage ought to be possible. And it was a move from the legal community, most of all, that led toward the institution of no-fault divorce. Between the mid-1960s and the early 1980s, almost all the industrialized world moved toward a no-fault divorce setup.
Now that the issue of gay marriage is coming up state by state, in addition to federal legislation and possibly a constitutional amendment, I'm wondering how states have historically honored other states' marriages and divorces.
Traditionally, there is a law regarding marriage that is not only national here in the United States, but international. It's part of international law that a marriage valid where it is celebrated is valid throughout. Now, that international law is, of course, observed where it does not conflict with the public policy of a given state authority. So that the United States, a country of immigration, has had an ambiguous position on that international law. For instance, the United States would not honor polygamous marriages in this country if polygamously married individuals came here as immigrants. Their marriages would be considered invalid as against United States public policy. And similarly, between the states, states honor marriages made elsewhere unless they fly in the face of articulated public policy on the part of the state, so that this was quite operative with regard to these anti-miscegenation laws that we've discussed before. If a couple living in Virginia where they could not marry, one being white, one being black, if they went to Massachusetts and got married, they could not come back to Virginia and live again. And so there is this one accepted exception to the general state policy of giving not only full faith and credit to the state's other laws of other sorts, but giving credence to a marriage performed elsewhere in general, but not if it's against the state's articulated public policy.
The 1996 Defense of Marriage Act defined marriage as a contract between one man and one woman. It also provided that no state would be required to recognize a same-sex marriage that was performed in another state. So outside of the anti-miscegenation laws, is this the first time that there was a marriage law saying that you didn't have to honor the marriage in another state?
One thing I can say for sure is that this is the first time there's been a federal marriage law of this range and, I mean, scope. Because while the federal government has been highly involved in marriage, it's been highly involved in indirect ways through things that it does have power over, such as immigration or interstate commerce or federal income tax, citizenship laws. There hasn't been the possibility for the federal government to legislate on marriage because it has been a matter of state prerogative. That's part of federalism. So I do think that the Defense of Marriage Act is unprecedented in that regard. From another point of view, it just states as positive doctrine something that has been part of an unwritten law up till now, and that is the exception of the obligation of a state to enforce another state's law, the exception on the basis of something that flies in the face of a state's own public policy.
Now, some people advocate civil unions as an alternative to same-sex marriage. That way, the marriage laws aren't changed. And the proponents of this say that civil unions are the same as marriage, except in name. Are there certain rights that a couple who is legally bound through a civil union won't have that a couple who is bound through a marriage would have?
I think there are two important levels of distinguishing civil unions from marriages. First of all, just the legal level. So long as civil unions are granted by states, as they certainly are at present and foreseeably will be, a civil union at the state level, like the setup Vermont has, can grant all the rights, benefits, obligations, and details of marriage to a couple within the state, but can say absolutely nothing about federal rights, benefits, privileges, obligations. And those federal details of marriage are hugely extensive. There are over 1,000 places in the corpus of federal law where marriage is implicated, and these include some of the major issues like citizenship, Social Security, federal income tax, immigration, and so on. A civil union united couple has none of those prerogatives of marriage. So there's a immense legal disparity, in fact. Then there's a separate level, which is the level of more symbolic status and prestige and the attributes of civil rights that are not literal, cannot be written down. And that is that marriage has become over centuries a privileged status, a privileged self-understanding and way of being recognized in the community, so that one couple who has civil union and another who is married, they're distinct in this more impalpable and symbolic way.
You're a historian. Do you feel like history is about to be made one way or another, either in the legalization of same-sex marriage or in the official illegalization of it?
Yes, I think it's a very important point to mark in the evolution of marriage. I do think marriage has always been a changing institution, and one could point to earlier watersheds, but perhaps none quite so explicit as this particular turning point.
And as a historian, are you taking an activist role on this in any way?
Well, I don't consider myself an advocate. I consider myself an informed participant, and it's been great fun for me to see how important history is to this turn of events, that people are unfortunately rather ignorant about the history of marriage. I'm happy to fill them in because it's important to understand where to go in the future, to know where marriage has been in the past, particularly to understand that it isn't one thing that doesn't have a static history and all of a sudden it's being asked to change. Rather, it's been a highly evolving institution. It's one of the reasons we still have marriage and still value it. It only would be with us still if it had changed.
Well, Nancy Cott, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Nancy Cott is a professor of history at Harvard University. She's the author of Public Vows, A History of Marriage and the Nation. We'll hear a different point of view on how history should inform the debate on gay marriage in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.